The Tabletop Miniature Hobby Podcast is proud to be sponsored by Dr. Spork's 3D Terrain. From retro greenskin outposts to elven fortresses and obelisks, this is hands down the best nostalgic scenery you'll find out there, and all at stupidly reasonable prices. Check it out for yourself by heading over to bedroombattlefields.com/spork, that's S-P-O-R-K, and turn your tabletop into a scene from White Dwarf circa 1994. Andy Chambers not included. Brought to you by bedroombattlefields.com, this is the Tabletop Miniature Hobby Podcast. Bedroom Battlefield's community member Martin is a regular contributor to our monthly hobby progress episodes, and I was keen to get him on the show for a more in-depth chat. Fortunately, he was happy to make it happen, and I kicked things off by asking him about DBA. It's a game that I hear mentioned a lot, but I know very little about it, other than the fact that it's been around for quite a while.
It came out in 1990 or thereabouts, and when it did come out, it was Phil Barker of the War Games Research Group, WRG, which people have a lot of bad things to say about, but are actually pretty fundamental to where we are in the hobby, to be honest. Phil Barker wrote the rules, and it was a very simple set of rules which took a different approach to what had been predominant before that. So prior to DBA coming out, writers had decided that to make things more accurate or realistic, they had to make things more and more complex. So it was getting to the point where you needed a degree in mathematics to play a game. And it got very, I think the modern term is granular, where there was so much detail that you didn't really get the feel of what the game was up to. But DBA did away with that. He had a trial run of something called DVSA at Society of Ancients conference. He had a very simple game with three or four different troop types, and the interaction between them was what was represented. So Phil Barker's top-down approach was basically that the general would only be able to see if his troops were advancing, cheering, holding their ground, falling back, or running away. So his game did away with all the counting of casualties and the analysing of detail, and stripped it down to a combat result based on their strength and their terrain type they're in, adjusted by a dice roll to give a result where the unit will either be doing one of those four things. It will either succeed, possibly pursuing forward, or it will hold its ground and dig its heels in, or it will back off, or it will run. So suddenly the game sped up from a slow game that would take you 2.5 hours to a game which could possibly be done in half an hour, 45 minutes. So yeah, it was very much a top-down view. So as the general, you can only see the basics of what's going on rather than being the centurion in every cohort. Yeah, it was very clever and groundbreaking in its day.
What do you think is there about the game that means, because like coming out, what did you say, 1990, 91? So what do you think it is about the game that makes it still popular and still played to this day?
Well, there's probably a few things that make it popular. There's a few things that make it unpopular too. But things that make it popular include that each army only has to have roughly 40 to 60 miniatures. So it's a very low figure count. If you play in 15 mil scale, which most people in Britain do, less so in the States, but in Britain, it's usually a 15 mil scale game. If you play it in that, you only need 12 chunks of 12 elements or units, around 50 figures, and it's played on a 2-foot by 2-foot board normally, or 60 centimeter square board. So it's very small in terms of the table size needed. It also has the advantage of being quite a quick game. It's designed as a fast play game and does play very quickly. So you can get lots of games done in a day rather than setting up a large game, which will possibly take you 3 or 4 hours. So when it comes to tournaments, which I go to quite a few of, you can turn up and get 6 games done against 6 different opponents. And it's loads of fun doing that. There's so many armies to choose from as well. The rules cover from 3000 BC to 1500 AD, roughly. So you've got everything in there from early Egyptians through to your Romans and Greeks through to late medievals, as far as Wars of the Roses or the Italian Wars, yeah. Variety.
How do you find those tournament environments? Because it seems like you're still very focused on theme and narrative and fun. We do hear sometimes the odd horror story about tournaments, but I know they're not all like that, and I would presume that you're enjoying them, that you go to them so regularly.
Yeah, true. I go to about a dozen a year, travelling, well, all over for it. But what are they like? In general, the DBA tournaments tend to be quite a friendly environment where people are out to have an enjoyable day of throwing some dice and playing some games. There is some competitive edge, but at the same time, it's a rule set which will bite you on the bum every now and again. So you can't get too focused on your wins and losses, because if you lose, you've got another game in 10 minutes' time. So fair enough, carry on. Yeah, what makes it popular? I think you can also play lots of games in a club evening. So if people go to clubs, they can get 2 or 3 games done in an evening, no trouble. The tournament side of it, yeah, lots of different formats. So some formats might focus on a particular period or troop type, and others might be inclined to make you fight with certain terrain types. Yeah, there's so many variations in it that it's hard to get bored. I think that's some of the contributing factors to why it's popular.
If you're playing historical, what eras do you really enjoy kind of playing within?
Well, within DBA, obviously it's within that 3000 to 1500, and I've got armies for many of the periods. So it's good to play against a historical enemy as much as possible. My favourites include the British Dark Ages, as they're called, or early medieval period, from about 500 to about 1000, with the Angles, Saxons, Picts, Scots, Welsh, whatever, sub-Roman British. Yeah, that sort of stuff I like. I've got some Greek armies, like those, they're fun. Mainly, I would say the variety is what makes it good, because one month you might want one thing, another month you can play another. Outside of DBA, I also get fun from playing ECW, or Wars of the Three Kingdoms, American Civil War, Colonial, a little bit of World War II. Yeah, all sorts, really. Yeah, it's my main focus is Ancients, a bit of Medieval, and other stuff too, yeah.
Yeah, you mentioned the Picts there. I really appreciated that book that you sent up to me with the Pictish stones. I was having a good read at that. I think it's only a matter of time before I get, like, I've not got any historical stuff, but it's inevitable I'll get a Pict army together. So where might I suppose it's a question of scale, but where might I kind of look for some Pictish stuff?
Oh, Pictish armies. Well, that's tough. There are people who do them in 28mm as kits. So possibly Warlord. I must admit, I haven't looked into those. 15mm wise, which is my usual, Essex Miniatures will have them. The ones I had, or have, are mostly from Feudal Castings, which was a company which was from, I think, England and Scotland at different times, and then was bought up by a company in the States. They may now be available from Thistle and Rose in the States, not sure. There are a few different makers around who do them. Yes, indeed.
Yeah, I think I'll probably end up putting that wee twist on it, like, you know, the Hadrian's Ward story that I did, and I maybe have the Picts, but backed up by Cthulhu, just to give them a wee bit more of a chance against the Romans. But I am fascinated with that era, just like off topic of the hobby, but I get the Archaeology Scotland newsletter, comes out every few weeks, and I was just reading recently there was some bad weather, shock horror, in Scotland, but it was up the east coast a wee bit from here, and somebody was just walking their dog on the beach, and I don't know if it was the tide or the wind or whatever had just completely sheared off this layer of clay that kind of boundaried on the beach to the wherever it was, just the fields behind it, and it was like footprints, human footprints and animal footprints. It turned out like the fair play to the dog walker, because they got the archaeologists up at the Uni Aberdeen on the site quite quickly, and it turned out this set of footprints was like 2,000 years old. So you're talking potentially before the arrival of Rome in Scotland, this footprint or these footprints. And within, I think, 3 or 4 hours, they were gone by, you know, the tide had come in. Fortunately, they got a look at them and documented them and that, but it's just one of the fascinating wee things where you just see something like that and it reminds you what a vibrant place Britain was in that era, where we just don't really have much information at all about it.
Yeah, the Picts were notable by not writing down records. So one of the reasons they're so mysterious is because they didn't write about themselves, which makes it a bit tough when you're trying to find out about them. But the stones, the carved stones they left, are absolutely stunning, beautiful pieces of art. Have you seen the Pictish stones in museums and such like other?
Yeah, definitely. They've got a good few of them in Dundee, Edinburgh. You could even, you know, there's a few notable ones out in the wild there as well. There's a wee site up near St Andrews where it's just this wee area and the trees, and there's faces carved into the stones and stuff. So aye, it's all these little clues, but obviously no writing apart from what the Romans wrote about them, or Bede, I think maybe 500 years later was that, when he wrote a lot about them.
He's a bit later, yeah.
Yeah, so, aye, fascinating period, and like I say, I'll inevitably collect an army. I've obviously got some of them for Foundry, the old naked guys, although I think I've posted out more of them to other people than I've actually painted up myself, but...
They're quite fascinating. The designs on the stones are really quite unique. Beautiful stuff. I used to occasionally get time in Scotland with a day off spare in Aberdeen, and you could grab a bicycle and get on a train, go inland and do a little tour, bouncing off all the different stones. And there's some beautiful stuff just tucked away next to a country road with an iron railing around it. And there's a great big stone from 1500 years ago staring at you. Beautiful.
Aye, you wonder, you know, a couple of thousand years from now, how much our footprints will be will be visible. I suppose it depends how we inevitably extinct ourselves, but maybe a meteor will sort that out. So you're talking about DBA there. I know that one of the other games that's a totally different type of game, one of the games that you play is Song of Blades and Heroes. How long have you been playing that?
It's a couple of 3 years now, I think. I was led to that by, there's a blogger in Australia, an ex-Brit called Alan Saunders, and he has a blog called The Stronghold Rebuilt, which was mainly focused on Hordes of the Things. But every now and again, he'd blog about the Song of Blade and Heroes games that he was playing. And I kept thinking, well, I must have a look. So, probably 3 years ago or so, I found a set of rules set of the rules and started having a go. And I was very pleasantly surprised at how very usable for solo games it was, for one thing. The swapping over of activation from side to side, and the inability to guess what was going to happen next made it really good for narratives. Yeah, you could write your own story at the end of it. It's a lovely set of rules. Yeah,
yeah, I'm a big fan of them myself. There are a couple of minor issues I have with it, but I think if I was introducing somebody to a miniature game for the very first time, it would probably be a no-brainer to use that for a multitude of reasons. Like, even if you look at the stick-based system for movement, so you're taking away the need for the tape measure, you're working with D6, there's not too much maths or that, there's not a high model count. So I think it's a perfect game for beginners, but also it has a lot of legs as well if you're wanting to play scenarios and you know that the rules will just tick away quietly in the background as well.
Yeah, it's clever. And I'm trying to think what the other thing was that maybe think how clever it was. The main thing I thought which made it an enjoyable game was the decisions you have to make during each game about how many dice you're going to risk. Because you might have that one thing you really, really want to do and you want to try 3 dice on it, but the risk of 2 failures and a handover, which would put you in a bad position afterwards, makes it... It's like a gamble, I guess. It's a bit like gambling.
What about any other game? I mean, you talked about the Rampant series, so what's your thoughts on that?
I like Lion Rampant, possibly because... Sorry, all the Rampant games, in fact, possibly because of the unpredictability of the handover. A lot of players are less keen and want more control, want to activate each unit every turn. But I like the fact that there is a decision to be made each time you pick a unit to activate as to whether you're going to risk activating the powerful but hard to activate unit or the easy to activate but less effective unit. So, yeah, I love the way it's slotted together. It's a very simple but cleverly built rule set. Yeah, it's also very adaptable. If you apply enough imagination to it, the Lion Rampant and the Dragon Rampant really do let you play almost with almost any army you can think of. So people join in. Well, on Xenos Rampant, they're using their GW Warhammer 40K stuff. In Dragon Rampant, people turn up with armies which were originally destined for Warhammer. So, yeah, it's a very adaptable set and cleverly bolted together. And it flows well with simple measurements and... it's very easy to get the game on the go and you get a game done in a couple of hours, no trouble. Yeah, love it.
Just changing things up for a wee second here. I know you said that you were retired and, you know, not a small percentage of listeners to this podcast have retired and a few more are kind of working towards it. How was, your expectations for the hobby when you were still working and you saw this retirement coming? How does that match up with the reality now that you are retired and now that you know what you're actually doing and how you're active in the hobby?
Well, that's a very good question. Before retirement, I was in a job where you didn't get much control of your life. So every month a roster would be published and you'd have to go and work that roster and it would involve strange hours, strange places and strange times. So you could never plan to be in a club or at certain events. It was quite hard to arrange your life. But all of a sudden, retirement opened up. Well, it all happened at once, in fact. Lockdown happened at the same time as retirement. So in lockdown, there was suddenly time to do stuff because work wasn't working. They weren't doing things much. And then I retired almost immediately after lockdown kicked off. And I found myself with loads of spare time and more projects than I can ever dream of completing in my lifetime. Basically, by having plenty of irons in the fire, retirement I found was a really good thing, because as a friend of mine says, I don't know how I ever coped before I retired, because there isn't enough hours in the day for all the things you want to do. So yeah, it's really opened the doors for me to do almost any hobby stuff I want to when I can fit it in. Yeah, it's been great.
I guess that transitional period, you know, during the pandemic would have thrown you into a situation where presumably you had like infinite painting time, but that it might have took a while for the playing to get going. Is that accurate?
Yeah, in terms of playing other players, yes. So lockdown for me meant only having to be at work a couple of times in the month, but the rest of the time, a lot of it was on standby for work. So you could effectively do what you wanted. Painting-wise, yeah, the queue had been enormous, and the painting queue was attacked with gusto, and I got loads of stuff done, which was good. Gaming-wise, I have since a few decades been a keen solo gamer as well. So I just applied myself to solo gaming and trying out new games like portable war game and one-hour war games. On a solo table, which worked good. It was a good opportunity to try stuff out. Yeah, get the painting done. Gaming with other people was problematic, of course. Yeah, we all struggled with that one. But I found a way around it by organizing a campaign by email. We had a little campaign on the go with DBA players who I knew, who were Dark Age players. So we ran a campaign where King Arthur and various other sub-Roman countries were trying to survive over a 20-year period while fighting each other and randomly generated opposition. And to get that going, what we did was the campaign mechanism would generate battles, and you'd get the owning player to come up with a deployment and a battle plan, and you'd find the opponent and get them to do the same. And then you take both of those order sets and pass them to a third person without telling them who was who or what was what, and got them to fight a solo battle. So it kept them playing and kept them involved with war gaming, which was fun. Yeah, that was a good way around it. But in terms of face-to-face, no, none of that. Didn't really work. I think we all struggled with that, didn't we?
Do you keep a table set up? Like, are you able to just leave a game set up and come back to it anytime you want?
I could, but domestic problems would probably result. We do have the space for a 3x4, which is good. It's where I'm sitting now, which is handy. So with permission, so to speak, I can leave a game up for a day or two. But generally, because they're faster play games, if I can set it up on one day and I can play it during the morning or the afternoon of the next day, and it can be gone. So yeah, I can set stuff up and leave it up. But generally, I try not to disrupt domestic harmony. That's the word.
Did you join your club post-retirement?
Yeah, I did indeed. There was a guy called Ivan who turned up at a couple of DBA tournaments. Nice guy. And he was a member of the Farnborough Club. And he said to me one day, I'm thinking of running some DBA days just to try and promote it a bit more within the club. And I said, well, I'll come along and join in. You know, he says, well, there's a joining fee and stuff. And I said, well, I'll come and have a look. So went along. They were a very friendly bunch. And they now have one evening every month of DBA, which has been good. There's between 6 and 14 players usually show up for that evening. It's the evening per month when the club can't use the big hall, but only the small hall. So it fits in with what the club needs to do. And I joined the club for that reason. But since then, I've seen other games I like. And that's when I've been starting doing the rampant games, having played one or two before I joined the club. I then got the chance to play against people out of the club, which has been brilliant.
What's got your attention right now in the hobby? What are you painting, playing, or planning for this month? Head on over to bedroombattlefields.com/voicemail to submit a clip for our monthly hobby update episode. That link again is bedroombattlefields.com/voicemail. And now back to the show. I might not be getting this 100% accurate, but I seem to remember in a recent question of the month, you were talking about a campaign that you were playing where if you beat your opponent, you push them back, towards presumably their territory and vice versa. And the aim is to try and push them all the way back. Is it something like that? Am I getting that right?
Yeah, they call that a ladder campaign. Basically, if you imagine a ladder sideways from left to right, there's a city at each end, which is the home base of the defending player. And in between, there are between 3 and 7 battlefields. You start the campaign by fighting in the middle battlefield, and whoever loses backs off into the next one, and the winning player advances to fight them, and if they beat them again, they push them back, and so it goes on until they get to the till somebody gets to one of the players' home bases, and then it's a fight to the death, basically. Because if you lose in your home base, you're out of the out of the campaign. Yeah, it's a very simple system, a ladder system. You can bounce backwards and forwards without ever getting to a point of reaching a conclusion. But the one I played, I lost 3 games in a row, and it was quite bloody. Yeah, it's loads of fun. Yeah.
How do you go about setting out the terrain for these battles then? Presumably you could tie that into the fact that you're pressing them, they're pressing you, and vice versa.
Yeah, there's lots of different ways of doing it. You can do it using the standard system for the rule set. So if it was DVA, for example, the defending player would choose the type of terrain items and then dice to see where they turn up on the tape. Or what I did for that one was I produced, I think it was 20 different terrain maps. Because it's a square and it's relatively easy to do. So 20 of those with terrain items on them, some very open, some more cluttered, some with rivers, some with a town in the middle or whatever. And then when it comes to the battle, you just throw a D20 and see which one you're on. And if you've used it before, you ignore that one and throw again. So that's one way of doing it, just a randomly generated terrain board, basically. So that makes it easier to get the game on the go quickly without lots of thinking about what do you want to do for terrain. And it also makes it less likely to be biased badly in the defender's favor each time, because defenders can set up terrains which are very suitable to themselves. So yeah, that was one way of doing it. Yeah, it was fun.
What does your terrain collection look like, and what proportion of it is homemade stuff versus stuff that you've bought?
Ooh, what does it look like? Too many boxes is one thing. most of it is built for 15mm games, DBA. The built-up areas, all the towns, cities and such like, a lot of those are 6mm or 10mm because they take a... They occupy a footprint which looks more appropriate for the area they're covering than having one building representing a town. which is what you end up having to do if using in scale very often. So yeah, the buildings wise, that's what I do. A lot of it is, well, the buildings tend to be bought and painted myself. The rest of the stuff is very often homemade. Like I posted some trees on the Discord the other day. I say homemade, they were made in China, but the trees were based at home. A lot of the terrain stuff I use is homemade or cobbled together. Yeah, I like seeing the posts by people like Carl in Chicago, who come up with some incredible terrain using very simple items, or toy bashing, as he calls it. Yeah, loads of fun.
Yeah, it's almost a little mini hobby inside a hobby, that, isn't it? The terrain building aspect of it. You've talked about multiple scales there. Do you have a particular favourite scale, or do you just feel it depends entirely on what you're trying to do on the tabletop?
Well, it sometimes depends on the space I have available. I've got some 28mm now, which I use for the Dragon Rampant, Lion Rampant, Xenos Rampant. And that is used almost always at the club where a large table is available, you know, a 6x4. Home games are almost always in 15mm. But I get use of a caravan, holiday caravan down in Kent, and when we go down there, I'll sometimes take 2mm stuff with me. I've got 2mm American Civil War, English Civil War, World War II, and now some Napoleonics, which William of William's War Games was selling. So they can be used on a very small table, which is good. Mostly low 15mm, which I know is one of your favourite scales as well.
What are some of your go-to miniature companies, like if you're picking up new stuff, which I assume as a hobbyist you're keen to do?
Yeah, I try not to pick up too much new stuff because, let's face it, we've all got that lead mountain, or the pile of opportunity or pile of shame. But companies I use for the historical stuff, one of the best ones is Essex Miniatures, because they have an enormous range, which is also very consistent in style and sizing, which some other companies don't manage. So Essex Miniatures I find really good. Now defunct Chariot Miniatures was lovely. They're currently in limbo waiting for a new owner. Other things I liked in 15mm. I like the look of your Ralph Arthur stuff. That's gorgeous. There's a guy called Paddy Green who plays DBA, who also does Frostgrave in 15mm. And he uses the Ralph Arthur for that. And they are lovely miniatures, and they paint really well by the look of it. Other than that, yeah, I mean, where you find stuff. 15mm, you're actually spoiled for choice. There are plenty of companies out there. Yeah, it's almost endless. Alternative Armies in Scotland, they do some good 15mm, which were the old 15mm.co.uk figures, plus fantasy, plus sci-fi. Yeah, there's an endless list, really.
How often do you paint?
It tends to come and go. I think most of us get that, I think, where you find that you get the painting mojo and you can't put a brush down for a week. Other times, nothing gets done for a month. And then you start beating yourself up over how you haven't done any painting. I was painting stuff yesterday, but I'd had a few days of doing nothing, and I'd been rebasing things, which is a chore in itself, but needed doing. But I started doing a bit of painting yesterday. But yeah, painting comes and goes. You've got to be in the mood for it, I think. It helps if the rain is lashing on the window, and it seems like a good idea not to be outside.
Christ, if that's the case, I should be a Golden Demon winner.
Yeah, I think you should indeed. Absolutely. Your painting should be perfect. Right? One thing about painting is my painting isn't to a brilliant standard. I see some excellent paint on the Discord group. There are some very good painters out there, and total admiration for. I've got other friends who are Very good painters. A guy called Colin down in Porchester. Very, very good painter. Does gorgeous work. And like Ivan, the guy I mentioned at the club, he does beautiful stuff too. There's many good painters out there, but mine isn't to a great standard. But one thing I was told many years ago is that the things to concentrate on to make it look decent are, it was the three Bs. It was banners, bucklers, and bases. So if you paint or if you apply really nice looking flags, good looking shields, and nice consistent basing, the army suddenly becomes really good. Old story, but in about 1990 odd, I was volunteered to fight in a tournament in Reading for a club with a set of rules I didn't know. And I got absolutely thrashed in, I think, three or four games. But at the end of the day, somebody passed me a Best Painted Army Award. And I was absolutely shocked because, quite honestly, I didn't think the figures were very well painted. But they were a Norman army with very pretty shields. I'd spent a lot of time making the shields look nice. And from the front, the bucklers part, the shields, looked really, really good. So somebody was impressed. The rest of the figures look pretty drossy, but I fooled them, obviously. So the three Bs were quite important. And I think I've seen that in quite a few cases now, but with a bit of application for those three things, the army really does come into its own. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think painting big army, and I totally relate to that as well with what you're saying. You know, I'm happy with my painting, but I understand I'm limited, but I enjoy it, and I'm happy enough with the results. But yeah, when you're thinking about an army as well, you could almost look at it as like it's an album, not a song. You know, take an individual miniature and do your best on that. You might think of that as the song, but yeah, an army could work as an album instead if that's an analogy that I'm not stretching too far.
No, that's a great analogy. It's the old Gestalt theory that the sum is greater than the whole is more than the sum of the parts. Yeah. So if all the bits slot together and it just looks good en masse, then you've won. Painting 2mm, for example, people laugh and say, how would you ever paint those? Well, you definitely don't paint the buttons. And you're lucky if you can paint the faces on. But if you put it on nice bases and maybe a couple of pretty flags attached to it, they suddenly look like quite a good little thing that you could game with. Yeah. It's a lot of it is overall effect rather than individual bits, in my case. Whereas other people who have very high painting skills will come up with some gorgeous miniatures, but would possibly take him a couple of years to construct the army. So my painting is possibly like your own. It inclined to look at getting the army to the table in a decent condition, yeah, rather than individual detail, yeah.
Yeah, well, that said, I can't believe you're not doing eyes and pupils at 2mm. You should really be getting that sorted.
Yeah, I know it's a big failing, and my microscope isn't up to it at the moment.
What paints do you use?
Well, I'm a bit of a philistine. I use quite a few craft paints. There's one called Americana, one called Deco Art. I use those for a lot of the basic stuff, but I also use the Vallejo or Vallejo. That company for a lot of the paints, the dropper bottles, because the dropper bottles are really handy and they seem to be paints with nice pigment in them. And when it comes to finishing off stuff these days, I tend to go for the Army Painter Soft Tone, which is a wash which will improve your figures 100% in a matter of a few seconds. And I'm very much one for that sort of approach. Yeah. So Vallejo is the better paints. The craft paints I use for lots of general stuff. And the washes yeah, having discovered washes over the last few years, they really do finish the figures off nicely if the sculpting warrants it, which usually it does.
What's next up for you then, Martin? What are you either planning to paint next, or have you got any games in the calendar?
Right, next up is this week. This weekend, I very foolishly volunteered to drive down to Cornwall to play in a DBA tournament down there. A guy who was running a tournament in Bude on the north coast. Now, it's a bit of a trek. But yeah, I'm going for that. That's on Sunday, which I'm looking forward to. A newish venue, so to speak. So somewhere different, playing against people I've never seen before. So that'll be good. Then after that, I've got a tournament in Sheffield. They've got a tournament in Sheffield called Leveling Up, which is very appropriate. And in that, you take a really bad DBA army and you put it in the pool and you don't use it all day. You use other people's really bad armies. And then you just desperately try for a win. Yeah. In each game. Yeah, that's one of the most fun things you can do is to be given absolute rubbish against somebody else who's got absolute rubbish and see who can fight their way through this. So that's gaming-wise, that's the next ones up. In terms of painting and prepping, I've picked up a sub-Roman British or Welsh 28mm army, which are gripping beast figures, I think, and I'm about 80% finished on the prep work on those. I haven't done much 28mm in the past, so they'll be a challenge, but they won't come out pretty, but they'll be decent. It's lots of spearmen, a few cavalry, and a few javelin throwers. Yeah, so that'll be fun. That's the next thing I've got lined up, and after that, probably more DBA stuff, I would imagine. There's a pile of figures awaiting paint. There's refurbishing projects on Wars of the Roses stuff. I've got a big heap of biblical stuff which needs the basing sorted out, which has been taking a while. So, yeah, plenty to keep me going. Yeah, enough to keep me going till I drop, I think. Yeah.
Well, it's been great to hear all about it, Martin, and I'm sure we'll continue getting updates from you at the Question of the Month episodes, and of course seeing any photos that you've got for us in the Discord as well. So I'd really appreciate you taking the time, and it's been really good to learn a wee bit more about your hobby experiences and what you've been up to.
Yeah, may I say that the blog and the podcast and the Discord group have been a great find. Yourself and the other guys on there have got such a spread of interest, and it's a lovely place to be because there's no pressures from anybody on what you should or shouldn't do, but everybody's got something to contribute in their own way, which is excellent.
Yeah, variety is the spice of life, as they say. So.
Absolutely. From 2mm to 28mm, that's what I say.
Yeah, and they're talking, I heard Jordan Saucery talking to Thomas Perrinen just on an episode there when I was out a walk, and they're talking about this new one from John Blanch and Co. On Guard. It's a fencing game. At 54mm. It's 1 miniature each at 54, so that sounds really cool. So yeah, it never fails to amaze me, just the diversity and options and you know, the limitless kind of creative freedom out there. So I'm looking forward to hear more about that.
It's stunning what people will do. There's a club in Durham who just posted that they're doing a demo game for DBA using 54mm figures, and I just can't imagine what that would look like. Yeah, so as you know, 50 odd figures per side. Yeah, it'd be great to see. Yeah, it's lovely. It's a great hobby. There's so much variety in it. You can do whatever you want to do, and don't feel pressured by other people to do what they want to do. Just do what suits and see who fits in with that. Yeah.
Thanks very much for listening to this episode of the Tabletop Miniature Hobby Podcast. If you enjoy the show, then please do share it with someone else you think might enjoy it too. And be sure to check out our Discord community of like-minded hobbyists, which you could find at bedroombattlefields.com/Discord. It'd be great to see you in there.